Dr. James Lineback is a practicing pulmonary physician with an academic appointment at the University of California Riverside College of Medicine as Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine. James Fallon is a neuroscientist and a professor at UC Irvine School of Medicine. This is James Lineback and James Fallon. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I'm here with James Fallon and James Lineback. Jim, for the sake of this conversation, I'm going to call Jim, refer to James Fallon, and Dr. Lineback, a little bit more formal, but we'll try to keep this discussion informal. Thank you to both of you for coming on today.
Great to be here, Duncan.
My pleasure.
Good to see you again.
So, Dr. Lineback, can you start off by just introducing yourself? You're a doctor, obviously, but what is your relationship in particular to the coronavirus pandemic that's going on right now?
Well, I'm a treating physician, and I have been for over 35 years. So I am not a primary care physician. I'm actually a pulmonary physician. I see patients with lung diseases primarily. So the things that affect the lungs, of course, will be smoking-related diseases, infectious diseases, as well as environmental diseases. And in doing so, I've been treating patients like that for quite some time while maintaining an academic appointment teaching physiology. So I have a bit of a different background because of the fact that I teach physiology, which is kind of the basic science of medicine, if you really want to think about it that way. In addition, I do a lot of expert witness work for attorneys. So in addition to being crucified by the attorneys, I get crucified by medical students too.
Yeah.
So I'm a very battered husband, you see. I get battered from all sides. But in all seriousness, the way that this works is that instead of seeing a patient and just thinking about symptoms, I actually have a different approach. I think about the physiology, what's going on at the tissue level. Hmm. So my focus is a bit different. It always has been, ever since finishing medical school in the 70s.
Okay. So have any of your patients come in and had coronavirus, or have you had any direct contact where you're treating someone and you realize, okay, this person is either has coronavirus or is at risk?
Yes.
Okay. Now, what made you want to talk about this on a podcast?
Good question. I trained as a basic scientist. Both Jim and I have master's degrees. He has a PhD in anatomy. So we trained as basic scientists, and a lot of what you're hearing now is about the science.
Right.
We hear that term a lot. And I'm listening to where the science is, and I haven't heard much about the science. I hear a lot about statistics, and I hear a lot about technology. But I haven't heard much about the science, basic science. Basic science meaning biology and applied biophysics and biochemistry, as well as that transfers into immunology, which is basically the system that deals with infectious disease that allows us to fight off infection, as opposed to AIDS patients who basically have no functioning immune system. So I actually thought I had something to bring to the table simply because of the way I look at things and because of my background.
Okay, and that's...
Not, and I can't, but to get just follow up with Jim, you know, you talk about experts. I taught for years medical students about the lung, the anatomy, physiology, histology of the lung, and lung disorders. And so in a way, somebody could have me on and say, well, he's a respiratory physiologist, and he knows about this, and he's got publications in virology, which I do, and in genetics, which I do. But that doesn't mean I'm an expert at all in COVID. So, you know, when you hear expert, it could be anybody. And what you're hearing a lot from, what most people read, are science writers, young science writers who are very passionate about something. And so they're writers about what the administrators of medicine or science tell. The other thing is, and just to support what Jim just said, that, you know, people, a lot of people confuse science. Well, say, I'm just looking at the science, and really they're talking about technology or engineering or just epidemiology, statistics. And you hear this in climate science all the time. What's the science? Well, there's no real science because there's no control groups or anything. So it's more numbers and descriptions, like Jim was saying, and that's what you hear from. And of course, these are easy to manipulate because people don't know what they mean, right? You can make a number seem very important, but it really is meaningless to the issue at hand. So, but this takes, I think, a long time to see a lot of this. You got to read a lot of papers and review papers and all this stuff to really get the sense of how numbers and statistics can be abused. And we see it all the time, you know, just so easy to manipulate this. I'm not saying everybody does, but sure. So one of the expert is, I, you know, since I've lectured for years on the lung and physiology, but I'm no expert in COVID or pulmonology, but I could be passed off as one. You see what I mean?
Yeah, sure. If you wanted to get on TV and claim that I have some
special... I get people like this all the time, but it's just, you know.
Well, so let me ask you guys then, what, Dr. Limebeck, when you make this distinction between science and statistics or technology, why is that concerning to you? What do you think we've been seeing in regards to the public conversation on COVID?
Well, it's really more of what we haven't been seeing.
Okay.
There's been a few articles in the Wall Street Journal that address immunology. There's been very few articles in the medical literature, oddly enough. Now, I've been involved in medical education for a long time, so I know what medical students learn. They don't learn much about immunology or physiology for that matter. So when the population doctors, if you will, the epidemiologists and the statisticians and the administrators, when they talk about these things, they're talking about large groups of people. And those are the only ones you hear from. You don't hear much from the primary care docs or from the critical care docs who are taking care of critically ill patients. Their perspectives are much different.
Okay.
Kind of a humorous anecdote. It might put this in perspective just a bit.
Please.
There's an old parable about five blind men interacting with an elephant, okay? You may have heard this. All five of these guys touch different parts of the elephant and they can't see him. One guy touches the trunk, one guy touches the tusk, one guy touches the foot, one guy touches the skin. And they all report different things, different findings. Now, the more they talk, the more angry they get because they think the other guys are all misrepresenting reality. Pretty soon they come to blows, as the parable goes. Does that sound familiar?
Sure.
Now, there's a moral to that parable. And that is that human beings tend to speak in absolute truths, if you will, based on their own limited subjective experience, while they're basically ignoring all the other guys' limited experience, subjective limited experience. Because remember, we're talking about three groups of doctors here. Just go with me for a second on this, because it might clarify some of this expert issue. Because number one, you got the critical care experts. These are the guys that are taking care of the people who are critically ill, they have high risk of dying, a good percentage of them do die. So from their perspective, a good percentage, if you get COVID, you have a good chance of dying, 40, 50%. Primary care docs.
Sorry, if you're a primary care doctor and you get COVID, you have a 40%?
No, if you're a critical care. You're okay. Working in the intensive care. That's my specialty, is the pulmonary and critical care.
You're seeing somebody who's going to die probably anyway. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Yeah.
So once the patients get to the hospital and the sickest of the sickest go to the intensive care units. Now, if you spend all your time in the intensive care unit, you're kind of petrified of this whole thing because it seems like everybody's dying.
Right.
Now, if you're a primary care doc, you're seeing regular people. And very few people die. A few of them get sick, but not many. And if you're what we call a population doctor, like an epidemiologist or a statistician or an administrator, you're dealing with populations of people. So a certain percentage of a big number, a small percentage of a big number is a big number. So you're petrified about this whole idea of people developing COVID because these large absolute numbers that are being projected petrify you. So you're making decisions that are different from the primary care doc and from the critical care doc. So I thought of this elephant parable, and it fits perfectly in my mind. Does that make sense to you or
yeah,
not?
Yeah, no, it definitely does. So I want to get a better sense then of what the elephant in the room, so to speak, would be here. Your experience is that because people who are in primary or intensive care see 40 to 50% of people getting COVID dying, that they're prone, just based on their own personal experience, to say, oh my gosh, this is a super deadly infectious disease, and we have to pull out all the stops to make sure that this doesn't spread. Whereas if you take a step back farther, you see that perhaps it's not as, I don't want to say it's not as big of a deal, but not as deadly or not as, deeply serious as these people might imagine?
Yes.
Okay.
Case in point, there have been several interviews of primary care docs. They've been on YouTube. They've been taken down.
Right.
Because they conflicted somehow with social media, and they seem to be underestimating the severity of it. But if you think about the different experts and the different parts of the elephant, with the blind man describing what he feels, it kind of makes sense, which leads us to where we're at in terms of the experts. So we might actually rethink the whole idea of what we mean by an expert. Who is the expert?
Yeah.
Is it the primary care doc? Because he sees a lot of patients. Is it the critical care doc? Because he sees the guys that are dying. Or is it the population doc who sees bajillions of patients? They don't really see patients. Remember, we're all MDs. But the population docs, if you will, haven't seen a patient usually in years or decades.
Right.
So their perspective is just much different, which leads to different conclusions about fact patterns, which leads me to back to basic science. And that's kind of a roundabout way of explaining how I got interested in doing this type of thing because of the lack of focus on basic science.
Well, that the weirdest part about the videos of primary care doctors getting, or physicians getting taken down, is that if there's one thing that I, as a non-MD, just layperson, has been seeing about the whole conversation around coronavirus, is that very few people fully understand what's going on here. And if anything, we could benefit from more voices, more a plurality of experts, if you will, than saying that, okay, well, this person doesn't fit the narrative, let's take their video down. And then the narrative 2 months later changes as more evidence comes to light. So you wanted to talk about immunology and things like comorbidities, the idea of a healthy immune system. Do you think that, because some people have been saying that, people have recommended, oh, take a lot of vitamin D, make sure you boost your immune system. And then people snipe back and say, okay, well, taking vitamin D won't actually cure coronavirus. It won't protect you. Do you feel like the immune system has been neglected in this entire conversation?
Yes. Case in point, and Jim and I have talked about this before, we are hearing now a lot about antibodies, measuring antibodies against the virus. Then we hear that, well, the antibodies disappear, so therefore, you're at risk for reinfection. So I got thinking about this, and I thought, well, wait a minute, time out here. Let's talk about basic immunology for just a second. Think about the immune system as being your army that's equipped to fight invaders. The invaders are viruses, parasites, and bacteria. If we didn't have those, we'd all die, like AIDS patients. AIDS patients have a barely functioning immune system, and once that gets overwhelmed, they die. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the immune system as being think about it being two biphasic phases. There's the cellular part and the, we call it a humoral part, which is the antibody part. Both of those are run by what we call lymphocytes, which is a type of cell. Now, the B lymphocytes produce antibodies. The T lymphocytes produce what we call cellular immunity. Now, guess which one of those we hear about more often? We hear about the T cells. Here's the problem. We hear B cells because they produce antibodies. Here's the problem. The primary immune response against viruses is not the B cell, it's the T cell. It's cellular immunity, which we can't measure. So we're measuring something that it's not terribly relevant if you really think about the science, because the primary response to viruses is cellular immunity, not humoral immunity. That's primarily bacterial.
Hmm. You're talking about a land war. The submarines are not going to play a big part, right? And really, I mean, that's what...
I see what you're saying. So, and Jim, I know you two sort of maybe have a disagreement here about the idea of, you know, the good physiology correlating with, you know, better organ function and sort of boosting the immune system in this way. Is that, did I get that right from our conversation earlier?
Well, I'll let him handle that first and put it in perspective.
Sure.
You know, I have a lot of friends, you know, like anybody does. And I noticed that a lot of my friends who are running all the time, they're in their 40s and 50s, they're always doing wind sprints and running. And I'd say, why, you know, why are you guys killing yourself? We used to do this in college, high school and everything. So what's this? And I said, well, I like to keep in good cardiovascular shape. And all of that. And I said, no, it's probably sexual, right? It's probably, they go, no. It's, and then almost all of them, as it comes to come to find out, had fathers, uncles, grandfathers who died early of heart attacks. Right. But they don't want to say it normally, unless you really push it. I always push it because it's like, what's the real reason you're doing? I'm interested in the real reason people do things, right? Yeah. What's the primary motivation? I know, of course, for secondary motivation, tertiary, you do that. But the primary motivator is that. So there are people who don't have that genetically in their family, so they kind of blow it off, which I do, right? My behavior is terrible in this regard. It's obesity, the drinking, and not exercising, you know, all of this. To me, the main thing is to stay cool and calm and relax. That is, to have a good time in life. And thereby, the scientific reason being, my immune system will be quite healthy. It won't always be hyperreactive, very reactive. I won't be suppressing my immune system because stress does this. So for me, you do things that avoid stress. Running every day would give me great stress, right. You know, just would. And it would be no good. It would be absolutely detrimental to my health. So there's a case where an individual, as opposed to a population, you could say, well, exercise is good for you. But if you look at what you yourself are, and you're honest with yourself and what you want, and what makes you live a happy life and a low stress life, it may be completely contrary to general health rules. I wouldn't advise my lifestyle to anybody, but I know me, right? I know myself, and this is how I want to live. And so for me, it's about that. Now, you know, there are people in my family who absolutely pristine lifestyle all their whole life. In great shape, exercise and everything, and they end up getting cancer, and they end up, you know, all this stuff. And of course, after they're okay or everything, most of the people that I know in my family are infuriated by it. They say, why don't you get sick at all? I mean, you're like fat, you're asthmatic, and you don't run, and you drink too much, you know, all that stuff. And in my other primary care physicians always get very angry with me. Because my blood work would come back and I'd have great, you know, lipids, I'd have all that would be great. And they would just really anger them. It just didn't seem right. So part of it is knowing your own physiology, your own immune system, and your own, what makes you happy and what stresses you out. And I just see a lot of people really spending a lot of time desperately to do the things right in terms of exercise and all this eating right. And they always seem freaked out to me and they get sick a lot. So that's my angle on it. what I'm saying is, this is my angle. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody.
Well, it does seem like stress is the number one killer. Like, and things like, you know, they say drinking a glass of red wine every night can prolong your lifespan. Well, okay, there's no way that any amount of a poison can help your body, but it's the fact that people are so stressed and they're able to relax maybe with a glass of red wine, that benefit outweighs the
alcohol. I can relax with 3 or 4 glasses of red wine.
There you go.
At my size and my sort of training in the field, one glass is not going to mean anything. That's a half an aspirin. But plus I enjoy it. It's just, you know, when it's social. I have a very intense social life in our family and everything. And even with their grandmother, and they were drinking wine and everything and food. So the social aspects, I think, are important too. So you got to look at yourself and your own situation and go from there. Now, Jim, I don't think Dr. Lineback is not going to exactly disagree with what I just said, but he knows what terrible shape I'm in. So he's absolutely always shaking his head, and he's like in perfect shape. And he's like an athlete, and he runs like crazy. He just does amazing things. But of course, he twists his ankles, and he hurts his shoulder, and that stresses him out because he gets hurt running, you know? Right. And so we're doing this stuff like he's still 20, 30 years old, which is, I mean, it's not funny. But in a way, it's funny because he really doesn't get hurt. But nonetheless, okay, Jim, did I give you enough ammo there?
Well, keep in mind, okay. I've known the good Dr. Fallon for nearly 50 years, 5-0, okay? I've known him when he was the same size as me, which is a few decades ago. And I've known that we had different lifestyles. Now, keep in mind that he's right, that he can do things other people can't do. He can sit down and close his eyes and go to sleep momentarily. Most people can't do that. He can basically ignore stress. He can have fun most of the time while other people are not having fun. Therefore, people are attracted to him. The more people that are attracted to him, the bigger audience that he has. And he's a performer.
You've gone outside the limits of the conversation.
And it's very effective. And people around him benefit, and he benefits. Therefore, if you look at that equation, he's right. With the running, I started running because I realized that everybody in my family died of heart attacks in their 50s. I started running in 1963, okay? Long time ago. And when I don't run, I don't feel good. When he runs, he doesn't feel good. So it's a different lifestyle. However, after seeing patients for over 35 years, you realize that very few people can do what he does. Therefore, if you look at the comorbidities now, and you look at obesity, it leads to the cellular mechanisms get kind of messy. But think about it this way. The fat cells are full of what we call inflammatory mediators, little chemicals that cause inflammation everywhere in your body. In the majority of patients that are in the obesity, morbid obesity group particularly, they develop diabetes and hypertension. Well, what does that lead to? It leads to premature atherosclerosis, which puts you at risk for a stroke and heart attack. So if you take that out of the equation and you say, okay, let's give them a regular lifestyle, and then along comes a virus. Their immune systems don't function well. Therefore, if you look at the intensive care units now, the majority of them are filled with obese patients. Hmm. It's not even the cancer patients, it's the obese diabetics primarily. So what's true for one group of patients may not be true for the other, but you see where we're, as far as administrative policy goes now in both state and federal government, we're all being treated as the same type of animal.
Right.
Which we are we are biochemically, but the physiology is much different with different populations. So, you know, for patients with compromised immune systems or the obese who are at risk for infection like this, the rules that are being set now make perfect sense. For those who are not at risk, not so much. Therefore, we're kind of like the elephant analogy, where now we're getting angry at each other.
Right.
Because everybody thinks the other group is misrepresenting reality. So that's why I love that parable.
When you talk about the disagreements, because now we're sort of getting to the the sort of shadow that's looming over this entire discussion we haven't mentioned yet, but which is obviously politics, where things like hydroxychloroquine get mentioned. And if you're a Democrat, you think it's nonsense. If you're a Republican, maybe you're already prescribed. But it seems like truth is being interpreted through the lens of party politics, where something like you just mentioned, obesity playing a role in people's susceptibility to coronavirus, particularly on the left, which I would probably consider myself a part of, but it's not, it's almost considered taboo to talk about, like, oh, well, how dare you blame these people for getting sick? But clearly what you're saying is that we're missing an opportunity right now to show people in real time the effects of taking care of your body and what they have in the midst of a pandemic, right?
I think it's a great point. Both Jim and I remember 1962 when President Kennedy came out with a program that focused on physical education for school children. He doesn't want to hear this, but it was kind of forced down our throats where everybody take PE and everybody exercise every day. And the reason for that was because of the World War II group, and I think it was like, the Korean War draftees, 1950 to 53. It was like almost 50% of them, 5-0, flunked the physical exam. Wow. And I thought, wait a minute, these are guys supposedly in the prime of their life. And President Eisenhower picked up on that. He didn't follow through. President Kennedy did. And the whole nation basically took on this whole MO of being physically fit. They even dared his cabinet to do a 50-mile hike in less than 20 hours or something like that. Yeah. But then we kind of lost it over the years, and it's been replaced by this sedentary lifestyle that works for some people, as Jim just pointed out, but for the masses, not so much. Like I said, you see patients for a number of years, you realize there's a couple of problems. One is, like you mentioned, stress. There is one article from about 25 years ago that talks about the percentage of visits to a primary care office that are stress-related. It was almost 70%. 7-0. I was stunned. And now you're looking at the prevalence of obesity of being, 42%, I believe, with 9% being morbidly obese. So we've got these risk factors for groups of patients that the current recommendations, the current dictums are making perfect sense for. But again, for the people who don't fit into those high risk groups, it's a feeling a different part of the elephant, if you will.
In terms of blaming people, blaming the victim, as it were, I mean, if I end up getting COVID and dying or getting one of these disorders having to do with my lifestyle, I'm not going to blame anybody.
Right.
I mean, I'm making this choice, right? And so why you would have this blame externalization seems very weird to me. You're going to be responsible for yourself. What's wrong with that? I mean, otherwise it's quite insane. So I make the choice to behave this way, right? And to act this way. And if I get it, it's like, don't cry for me. I mean, I'm choosing this. And so at any rate, and there are people who are genetically fat and genetically diabetic and all that stuff, but they're choosing not to go the extra mile to fight it. You know what I mean? It's not like it's their fault genetically. So a lot of people, you hear some of it and you hear people complaining about things and you look at it, you listen to them, and you realize what they're doing is complaining about their genetics, right? And they want to blame the world for their genetics. It's like, well, we're sorry, It's like, but I don't see any worth. It doesn't help anybody doing that.
Well, let me challenge you on this though. Like a lot of, it seems though a higher percentage of people in poor communities and communities of color are dying or contracting coronavirus. Where if you're, bad food tends to be cheaper, like McDonald's tends to be cheaper than Whole Foods, let's say, where it seems in some ways it's not a luxury to be healthy, but it definitely, if you're poor, it's harder to get those good ingredients, right? So
today it's harder to get good ingredients?
I would say it's a little bit more expensive to shop in nice places.
I mean, if you look at the populations in non-white communities, you know, historically, do they tend to have a much more high blood pressure, much more obesity? Any rate, I mean, let's ask Jim that.
Please. Yes.
Yeah, the incidence of obesity is much higher in those communities, as are those other risk factors. For example, hypertension among African Americans. It's not just hypertension, it's deadly hypertension that leads to premature atherosclerosis, stroke, heart attack, and kidney failure. That's what the black population is faced with. The other problem in that community is the incidence of obesity. If you go into the Hispanic areas, you'll see a high incidence of obesity, as you will in the African-American population, which again, by definition, makes them at high risk. So it's not just nutritional, but it's going to be, I call it lifestyle, but you're right, the nutritionists have published data on the cost of nutritious food versus junk food.
Right.
Junk food, cheaper. Sorry about it, that's just the way it works. But it's not just the nutritional part, it's part of this big picture that we hopefully will be able to better define after the quote real science tends to emerge from this.
Okay, so there's a confluence of complex factors here, but one of the things I wanted to ask about, because we talked about this before the podcast had started, and it was stuff like solar radiation, nasal breathing. We should take those separately, but let's start with solar radiation.
Good question. There was actually an article that just came out in June of this year in one of the physical science journal of photochemistry or photobiology, something like that. It was very well done, and it looked at the couple things. Number one, the use of solar radiation, UV radiation, as a virucidal agent. The reason it caught my eye is because at the beginning, I remember when they closed down the ski lifts, they closed down the swimming pools, and then they closed down the beaches. And I thought, wait a minute, we got a problem here. Because I know that microbial agents are sensitive to UV radiation, and they don't survive outside very well. So this author actually measured the survival rate of a virus in midday sun. And he found that 90% of the virus was eliminated, basically, inactivated, within 10 to 30 minutes. So what that really means is that if you go outside, that you've got an ally, you've got the sun, you've got UV radiation, it's basically killing the virus. So, and I kind of looked at this like I did the immune system, like you got the troops, and we're equipping the troops with defensive measures, you know, go mask up and go hide in the closet and stay away from the virus, as opposed to looking at the basic science literature that says, okay, think about this for a second. What can we do to kill the virus? Because we don't really have a drug that kills the virus very effectively.
Right.
However, we got solar radiation. So if you think about that simple principle in basic science, everybody should be outdoors. If you really think about that, I'm not making any political statements or anything or criticizing. Right. I'm just saying that if you really get back to basic science, you can't argue with data. By data, I mean the real science when it comes to physics and chemistry that determines biology. So the whole idea of playing defense is going to lead, kind of like a football game, eventually the other team's going to score and you're going to lose. So if you think about an offensive mindset, we should really be outside.
Yeah. Well, and how about the indirect thing, Jim? Just if I can,
please.
With vitamin D3 and being outside, that is these other things having to do with being out in the sun.
Sure. It's like a double whammy. Staying inside, you get no vitamin D and no solar radiation. You go outside, you get both of those. And the other thing that this author pointed out was that the COVID virus was three times more susceptible to UV radiation than influenza A. So it's more susceptible to influenza. Mm. And yet we're closing beaches, we're closing swimming pools, and we're closing ski resorts. I'm scratching my head going, well, where's the science? Just a question.
Well, let me follow up on that then. A lot of people are saying just take vitamin D, like a supplement. If you take a lot of vitamin D supplement, will that have the same effect?
Well, probably not, because you're talking about two different things. The vitamin D is actually supplementing your immune system, whereas the solar radiation is killing the virus.
Okay.
And leading to additional manufacture of vitamin D.
And what does sunshine do to the activation in skin cells of vitamin D? What does the sun do?
You know, I actually don't know. I don't know the chemistry of the vitamin D manufacture in the skin. But there's been more than one study just in the past 6 months showing that it's definitely a real phenomenon.
Yeah.
And what does vitamin D in this case, if you just took it as a supplement, let's say you can't really get outside, you're a part of the lockdown and you're taking this supplement, should you feel significantly more at ease? Is it enough? Is it worth going out and purchasing this yourself?
Well, based on the studies that have been out over the last 6 months, probably yes.
Okay.
Because it's one of those unusual supplements that is both a supplement and a hormone. And I won't bore you with the details and the distinction, but it has a number of different actions that are beneficial in several different organ systems. So even before this came around, vitamin D was emerging as being a supplement that doctors were starting to recommend, even though we don't, in medical education, we don't really teach much about supplementation. But so therefore, most doctors kind of avoid the issue of supplementation entirely. But even before the coronavirus, like the primary care docs were starting to talk about vitamin D supplementation as being one of those, you know, you should be taking just for your overall health.
Mm. That's interesting about the supplementation. Because supplements are a huge industry at this point. Do you feel like their usefulness is exaggerated, or do you think doctors have just not caught up to this new wave of science?
Could I respond with both?
Please. Yeah, sure.
Multiple choice. No, seriously, we have never taught, we teach biochemistry to medical students, but we don't really teach supplementation because it just hasn't been incorporated into the medical curriculum yet. Now, if you go back to when we were kids, everybody started talking about a multivitamin, either it was beneficial or it's not beneficial. Well, most of the studies show it wasn't beneficial. Therefore, they talked about expensive urine because you were just taking a supplement that cost money and urinating it out. Well, those days are gone. Now, instead of taking a multivitamin, we're actually, that's shotgunning, if you will. So think about a multivitamin as being a low dose of the things you do need and a low dose of the things you don't need. Mm. It's like a lose-lose deal.
Yeah.
So now we're taking a more rifle approach where you're looking at, okay, what are your goals here? If you were at risk for coronary artery disease, if you're at risk for rheumatoid arthritis, if you're at risk for premature atherosclerosis, et cetera, you're going to want to control the things that lead to problems in those disease population, in those disease groups. For example, patients with rheumatoid arthritis, they have inflammatory joint disease that's just horrendous. So you want to control the inflammation with, you know, a simple anti-inflammatory like omega-3 fatty acids. The data is very clear. It works very well. Oddly enough, it also works in prevention of coronary artery disease because the same inflammatory response that occurs in the joints occurs in the coronary arteries.
So Jim, do you take them and do you recommend them to patients depending on what they have and what would be useful? Do you recommend nutraceuticals, nootropics, or anything like that?
Yes, only with a certain number of supplement companies, because remember, this is not regulated by the FDA. So there was a rather disconcerting study about 10 years ago looking at, the FDA actually looked at 50 supplement companies, 100 supplement companies, something like that. And they found that almost a quarter of them misrepresented their contents in the individual packets. So you got to be real careful about where you get these things because they're not regulated and they can say anything they want on the bottle.
So they can be in a form that the body can't use, right? I remember when people tried to get calcium by taking crushed, clam shells because they had a lot of calcium and taking it, because, but it was not in a form that the body could use, right?
It's like eating rocks. They say, well, there's calcium. Yeah, there's calcium in the rocks, but, you know. So it's turned out to be a big industry because people are not wanting to take drugs and they want to do something else. And the supplements seem to be much more acceptable, I guess, in their search for some non-drug solution.
Okay. And the other thing that you had mentioned was that, I don't know if you said that it could kill the virus, or why don't you just explain nasal breathing, breathing through your nose. What does that do?
Well, I teach pulmonary physiology. So I've always thought about this in terms of breathing. I think about weird stuff just because of my background.
Right.
So I got thinking about, okay, I just lectured to the medical students last year on the upper airway. So when the virus thing came out, I thought, now, why are we covering our noses with the mask? Because we want to be breathing through the nose. And then this article came out from University of California, Merced, just this summer. And they looked at nasal breathers versus mouth breathers. It was very interesting. They looked at they talked about the regular filtration effect of filtering out viruses and bacteria in the nose. You have those hairs that stick out of your nose are there for a reason. They're not just to disgust your girlfriend. They're there for a specific reason. It's to filter out dust particles and infectious particles, bacteria, viruses, etc. And in addition to that, what I didn't know is that the sinuses actually produce nitric oxide. Now, nitric oxide is a very interesting chemical because it causes the dilatation, the increase in the size of the capillaries, the blood vessels. In addition, nitric oxide kills the virus. So I'm scratching my head thinking, why don't we hear about this in the 6 o'clock news or in the LA Times? Instead of how many people died, what can we do to, I call it, equip our troops, if you will? And this is another thing that it's a simple thing that instead of breathing through your mouth, you breathe through your nose. Now that's basic science. That's real science. Mm-hmm. And you can point to that one article. It's not a big group. It's only a couple hundred patients, but it brought out something I didn't know about, which was nitric oxide is an effective agent to inactivate the virus and to kill the virus and to prevent viral replication. So breathing through your nose is actually much more.
How does using a mask affect nasal versus mouth breathing?
You know, it gets very complex and it depends on the type. Because remember, the physics are very different. I've seen firefighters for 30 years, and in the old days, they never used any masks at all. And then they started using these loosey-goosey masks and they were ineffective. So if you look at the literature, it's very confusing because one physicist looked at a meta-analysis, which is looking at a number of studies, and he found as many studies to support the efficacy of masks versus those that did not. So it's very confusing. And I don't really know the physics of the individual type of mask. It's not really my area of expertise. But suffice it to say that when it comes to breathing, you want to breathe through your nose. Say you're in a bar. You got no matter, you're at risk of whatever. You breathe through your nose, you're probably going to filter out most of the viruses, and those that enter the nasal cavity are probably going to be killed by the nitric oxide, unless you have a compromised immune system, or you have limited troops, or you have a particular overwhelming viral load. Remember, these viruses are particles. So we talk, like with asbestos, we always talk about particle load. How many particles are in your lungs? So you think about the viruses in the same vein, except you can't see them. So if you run somebody that sneezes or whatever with the virus, you're going to be inhaling a viral load that may overwhelm your lymphocytes. So you want to make sure that you don't want to put yourself in those type of positions because the mask probably isn't going to help that much. But so, and even nasal breathing, all you're doing is trying to minimize the risk of overwhelming your lymphocytes. That's really the name of the game.
So in that case, because again, this is me speaking as a layperson, the idea of putting a mask on your face seems like a good idea, just because maybe it could block some of the virus coming at you. That might be a totally clueless way of looking at this. But would you still recommend people to go around wearing a mask but breathing through your nose?
I'm going to punt on that one, because that's the kind of thing that can get me in trouble.
Okay.
Nobody knows. Yeah, but I mean, if they,
well, we don't really know. And I don't want to get into a position where I'm making recommendations, because like I said, that's not really my area of expertise. Sure. I really want to stick with the basic science per se.
But I can answer something.
Good.
Okay. Based on the logic that any type of masks that would increase nasal breathing versus mouth breathing generally should be better, right?
You'd think so. I just don't know.
Think so, right? I mean, but if you go with that principle, you don't know, because the study's not really been done yet, but there's that.
Yep. See, this is why it's important to have discourse on these different issues, because we're feeling different parts of the elephant, if you will. And we want to get away from this absolute truths. You know, he's right, I'm wrong, he's wrong, I'm right, he's wrong. And get away from it, because we all have limited subjective experience when it comes to a lot of these issues. And in clinical medicine, we do this all the time. One of my buddies is an engineer and a money manager, and biology drives him nuts. He says, there's no rules. You break rules all the time. And he's used to very structured environment. You know, money is what it is, and it does this and this, and engineering does this and this. He says, I couldn't do biology. It would make me crazy. Well, in clinical medicine, we're faced with these decisions all the time based on limited experience and really limited clinical guidance in the literature. Because once you get into practice, it's hard to read the literature, and it's very expensive to go to meetings. So if you start doing things, that's why you have to continually reevaluate what you're doing and how you do it, because it could be wrong. But unless you have this kind of discourse, these kind of discussions about the opposing viewpoint, then you could go on doing the wrong thing for a long time.
Yeah, one of the engineers I work with, he was one of the guys back in the early 70s that developed all the visualization hardware and software for like Star Wars, all that early stuff. But we did papers together on the development of cortex. He's an engineer. And he had the same sort of thing. He said, he was basically, you biologists drive me crazy, because you say, well, how many cows are out in the field? He goes, you go out and measure the physiology of the cows, and then, you know, do all these things. He says, for an engineer to determine the number of cows in the field, you just walk out in the field, count the number of footprints, and divide by four, and that's it.
Nice. That's the point about having a discourse on this issue, and it taking time for the science to catch up, because this pandemic did seem to catch people by surprise largely. What about, do you have any strong opinions, either of you guys, on the vaccine efforts? Right now it's being called Operation Warp Speed, which has some people sort of rattled that perhaps you know, corners will be cut, and particularly in places like Russia, where, you know, it seems like the standards for medicine might be a little bit laxer. But what about a vaccine? Do you think that there's a reasonable timeline we can expect? Do you have any strong opinions of the efforts underway?
From my point of view, the public demands these contradictory things. They want absolute safety, and they want to be able to sue everybody if it doesn't work. On the other hand, they want to be immediate, effective things to happen, right? At no cost to the society or them. These are quite at odds with each other, right? So I want it now, I want it to work, it's got to work perfectly, but it's got to be completely safe, and I want to sue anybody involved. Well, this is absurd, isn't it? So if you ask the question in that way, in terms of vaccine, it becomes a different question.
Fair enough.
And the vaccine really outside my area of expertise. So okay. I'm not really qualified to talk about it.
Fair enough.
Neither am I, but I just said so.
But you're a professor, though.
They would get away with anything.
Let me ask this then. Because what we've been talking about would lead one to believe that, okay, there are common sense measures that have been ignored that would boost people's immune function. And there are certain restrictions that have been put in place, like shelter in place and closing beaches and areas, as you mentioned, that you can get a lot of sunlight at. Why do you think that is the way we've handled this response? Is it just a brute force, blunt instrument that we're applying here? Do you think there's something else at work? What's your opinion?
You know, that's a good question, because I asked myself the question just at the beginning, right in the middle of all this. I just happened to read the book on the 1918 viral influenza pandemic just a couple of years ago. And I was thinking then, okay, what would happen if the same thing happened today? So I thought through all this. Now, back to the immunology. In the numbers from 1918, they were hideous. Like a third of the world population got infected, and there were like somewhere between 20 and 50 million deaths and 600,000 or 700,000 deaths in the US. It was a big deal. People were dying in the streets. Now, if you don't know anything about immunology, you really don't know much about physiology, but you heard, and remember, there aren't very many people today that were alive in 1918. And if they were, they were probably kids. So all we know about is what we read. Now, if you're an administrator and you hear this horror story from a generation ago, 100 years ago, and you don't know basic science, you can't spell immunology, and you wonder, what should I do? So in answer to your question, my take on that is that because of these horrendous numbers from 100 years ago, that these projections were probably in error because they were made with emotional decisions instead of objective decisions, because they didn't really know the basic science. Now, that's my take on it. I can't support that with medical literature. That's just my opinion.
How many of those soldiers who fought in World War I, right, especially on the Western Front, how many then, you know, were passing it amongst themselves and then went back home to rural communities in Europe, in the United States, Canada, where there was no, there may have not ever been any sort of infectivity from that virus? Does that ever come into play? That is, it's like the native culture that has never been exposed to smallpox, for example, right? And so everybody dies. But if you have the herd immunity there, at least partial herd immunity, how much you think of that played a role? And you just, you know, it's a guess, in the 1918-1919 pandemic.
Well, that's exactly what I asked myself when I read through the book. Could this happen again? Well, anything's possible. But think about 1918. My father was born that year. He lived in South Dakota. He lived on a farm, and they never went anywhere. They had no money. They never saw any other people. They milked the cows, and they went to eighth grade, and they quit school. Now, think about the viruses and the bacteria that they were exposed to in their childhood and their young adulthood. Think about their immune system. It was almost equivalent to what you pointed out in 1492 when the Spaniards came to North America. They didn't get smallpox, but the Indians...
So completely naive, immunologically naive populations.
The Native Americans died.
Yeah.
In droves, because they had naive immune systems. They had lymphocytes that couldn't react, where the Europeans, as you know, had been exposed to cowpox. What is cowpox? Well, it's just a low-grade form of the same infection, which is basically a vaccine. And of course, you know, that's where it came from. But I think probably what happened in earlier this year was that those were the factors that the powers that be had in their mind,
sure,
that had this in the back of their mind, because I think they must have, in answer to Duncan's question about was this brute force, it probably was brute force, because it was an emotional decision based on those types of models that today don't apply. Question, how many people do you know that grew up in a neighborhood and never left it? You don't see it anymore. Yeah. 1918, you've got troops that came back from Europe. They came back to Kansas, to the farm, or South Dakota, and they encountered colleagues who had naive immune systems, and the results were much the same as 1492. Okay. It was the same principle.
That was true in rural France and in the eastern part of Germany, rural Germany, and certainly in Russia. A lot of those, you know, peasant, they're agricultural communities. They're completely naive immune systems. Yes.
So if you could today basically analyze cellular immunity, the efficacy of cellular immunity in the population, it would be very good, other than in those high-risk groups. Now, everybody's going to bring up the idea, well, there's this one guy that was a marathon runner and he got sick and died. Right. Well, it's a matter of keep in mind the particle burden versus your lymphocytes. You can't overwhelm them, if you will. So what that would imply to me, even if you have a good immune system, if you get your particle burden is too high, you're going to overwhelm it and you're going to have a problem.
Right. If you take a coronavirus bath, it doesn't matter how strong your immune system is.
I like that.
Well, on that point, do we think that herd immunity is achievable, a good idea, or what are your guys' thoughts on that?
You know, I knew you were going to ask that question, so I looked up the definition of herd immunity. It's one of those things you've heard about for the last 6 months, and I haven't heard anybody define it. So I looked it up, and guess how many definitions I found? Seven. Yeah. Seven definitions. So I'm not quite exactly clear what it means, but if you think about the immunology of this, one of the academics sent me a thing the other day. It was provocative, simple but provocative. He said, look, think about it this way. You're either immune or you're not immune. Pretty straightforward. The only way you can get immune is by exposure.
Yeah.
And there's only two ways you can get exposed. One is to the virus directly or to a vaccine. You're not going to get immune hiding in the closet with a mask on. You can put a pillow over your head. Ain't going to happen. So as far as the logistics go, you're probably looking at, quote, herd immunity, meaning everybody's exposed eventually and building up cellular immunity at some point. Or they're going to become symptomatic because you're going to be exposed eventually. So this is my own opinion. I haven't really looked at this in the literature, but if you think about the person-to-person spread, eventually everybody's going to, unless you go live in a cave in Montana, you're going to be exposed. You either have immunity or you don't. You just want to make sure you don't get exposed in high dose. And I think that probably, however you want to define herd immunity, it just means reducing risk.
And that what we were talking about in terms of the 1918 pandemic was one type of herd immunity, or the lack of it.
And
that's one of the seven definitions, yeah.
People in the 1918 pandemic, the reason it went away, it wasn't because there was a vaccine created, right? It was because there was some form of herd immunity, or what happened there?
Most
population explosion went from logarithmic until enough people had developed immunity, and then it just flattened out.
Which is one way of defining herd immunity, I think.
Right. Yeah. It's a statistical phenomenon based on exposure in population, yeah.
I just wanted to follow up with some the thing that Jim talked about with him being at risk. The other extreme is someone like myself, who went to medical school at the University of Illinois. I was in a university hospital, Cook County Hospital in Chicago. Then I did my internship residency at LA County Hospital in LA. And then I worked in every emergency room in South Central LA.
Like two MASH units, hyper-urban MASH units, right? Everything.
I've been exposed to every, I'm joking, but it seems like I've been exposed to every microorganism on the planet. So both cellular and humoral immunity is pretty effective, because I get sick about, I was sick for one day about 20 years ago. I was actually in bed.
Wow.
Other than that, I really don't remember the last time I was sick. And I'm turning 72 in a couple of weeks. So it has to do with the exposure and physiologic status of the rest of the organ systems, of course, in order to mount an adequate immune response.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask, because so far with the pandemics that we've experienced, at least in my lifetime, and I imagine in both of your guys' lifetimes as well, they have been either very deadly, but not highly spreadable, or they've been like Ebola, or they've been like coronavirus, where they seem to be highly spreadable, but not very deadly. Are those two things connected, or can we expect at some point to have some sort of pandemic that is highly spreadable and deadly?
Well, it's a good question, but I'm going to invert the question.
Please.
Based on immunity, on the immunity of the masses, if you will, that, and again, this is my own opinion, I'm not an expert on immunology per se, but I thought through this and I thought, okay, because I don't know the answer to the question, first of all. But if you think about eventually immune systems becoming more competent over time, it's going to take care of the infectivity, however you want to define that, and the severity. So your lymphocytes will determine that. Mm-hmm. And everybody's lymphocytes are not the same. So in my mind, our goal would be to improve the status of your army, your T cells and your B cells. Because then it becomes a different equation.
We've gone on here for about an hour and a half. I want to kind of wrap up, unless you have anything that we haven't talked about. But I wanted to ask you finally about, because we've been talking about boosting the immune system, to people listening to this right now, what should they be doing? How do you think they should conduct themselves in relation to the lockdown, whether that means going out and getting more sun? And how do you think they should conduct or change their relationship to their own personal health, perhaps, to boost their immune system?
You know, personally, I've been poo-pooing it as a big problem. It may sound a negative. Here are the nutraceuticals I take. Mm-hmm. Every day I go out for an hour and a half in the sun in my jacuzzi. I take vitamin D. I do all of these things that are comfortable for me to do.
Yeah.
I refuse to lose 50 pounds. I'm not going to do it. But I will do that. And, you know, other than Jim, who's extremely knowledgeable about this stuff, I'm very reasonable. I come from a family of compounding pharmacists who many, many of them, and they all recommend this, and they are dealing with patients who are coming in with different kinds of coronaviruses, with other things. And they recommend these, the nutraceuticals. They think it's great that I go out in my jacuzzi or in the sun. I was always a beach guy too, right? And it also helps for people, you know, by getting that blue light in the morning. Some people, it helps for depression. Getting blue light shifts the circadian rhythms a bit for people. So there's all sorts of positive effects. In addition to what Jim was saying about the direct cytotoxic effect of UV and IR radiation on viruses at the beach, for example.
Doctor, your thoughts?
Well, it's hard to argue with the medical literature. So the sunlight thing is what it is. The nasal breathing is something that most people don't really talk about. They don't even think about it. Now, one thing that just occurred to me as we discussed a lot of these things, keep in mind that in biology, in nature, there's balance, okay? And that old Hollywood adage, if a little bit is good, a lot is really good, that's just not true. Okay? And it's true for Professor Fallon, would be glad to hear that it's certainly true for exercise. Marathon, birds get heart attacks, okay? You could overdose on anything. Okay. You can get too much sun. You can get too much stress. You can get too little stress. Balance is really a pretty good MO to follow in your lifestyle. Too much food, too little food. It just always works that way. Now, in terms of what you can do specifically, moderate exposure to sun, the nasal breathing, supplements. As far as the immune system goes, the vitamin D has been shown, the supplement, the vitamin D has been shown to be efficacious. And I haven't seen any real good studies on zinc, but I'm told that most of the supplement companies are sold out. So that is apparently already being accepted. But in terms of activity, sedentary lifestyle is not good. Too much extra, the marathon running is not good. Being a couch potato is not good. Somewhere in between is going to be beneficial. Walking is better than sitting. You don't have to run. You don't have to run marathons. But the body was made to move.
My mother is very fond of Jim. You know, very, very fine. And she said the same thing that Jim said. Now she lived to 102. You know, in her, you know, she just died what, a couple of years ago. And what did you see about her? Now this is only one person, right? But what struck you about her life and her longevity and her robustness of her health struck you? Because she's saying what you said, the balance is everything. And she even, you know, at 100, she was taking a little glass of red wine and doing a little bit of meat, a little bit of it was a little bit of everything.
But, you know, those are easy principles to follow.
Yeah.
But again, moderation, movement, nutrition, you know, a little bit of junk food. I always tell patients, if you eat good fats first, go ahead and eat the junk food. Because by the time you eat the good fats, got to define what the good fats are. You won't even want the junk food. It works. It's called moderation. And stress and sleep. This, like I said, 70% of visits to primary care physicians are for stress-related disorders. I found that astounding. 21st century, that was 20th century, but, and the idea of a comfortable lifestyle is additional money, which means more work, which means more stress, which means it's counterproductive. So you don't want to work too much. You don't want to work little because having no money is stressful. And then sleep. The data on sleep, recent data, is really quite provocative. They one meeting a couple of years ago, they showed that anything less than 9 hours sleep at night, you start making bad decisions. And I thought, how many people do you know that sleep 9 hours a night? Again, balance. So there's one take home with respect to lifestyle. It's balance.
There's I've balance. Had a lifetime of bad decisions on 4 hours a night of sleep.
Well, some people can tolerate it.
Yeah, that's the point.
My wife can tolerate it. I can't. Most patients can't. Bad things happen. So.
Wow. Well, thank you. Both of you for doing this. Jim, thank you for introducing me to Dr. Limebeck. And Doctor, thank you for taking the time to talk to the public about this. It's like what you said in the beginning about the elephant. I mean, this is definitely a conversation that would not take place on like CNN, but it's very valuable. So I appreciate both your guys' time.
Doug, it's great that you're doing this. Because the explanations are not short, right?
Right.
They're not sound bits. And I've done enough CNN interviews and NPR, you know, it's like little bits, and you never get anything out. So do you know, offer a platform and a way to talk about this more fully? And hopefully out of all this, you'll get a couple of good minutes.
Oh, yeah. This has been great for me from start to finish. Hopefully other people feel the same. And I hope you guys had a good time as well.
Yeah, I did.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Doug.
There we go.
Okay.
Thank you to Dr. James Limebeck and Jim Fallon. Thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.